This is day three of the 2010 Ottawa Bible School. Our second period teacher is Brian Ryan Mutter. His general topic is the Ecclesia at Ephesus. Today's topic is A Wide Door for Effective Work Has Opened to Me.
Good morning, everyone. Before I begin to talk again about the Ecclesia at Ephesus, I just wanted to let you all know that our little David is back from the doctor. He's okay. And I just wanted to thank you all for all of your concern and for all the support everyone has shown to us. It's been really, really wonderful. So, back to the study of the Ecclesia at Ephesus. Well, there's only one place in the Bible where the phrase special miracles occurs. We're not just talking about miracles here, we're talking about special miracles. And that one place where it occurs is in Acts 19:11. And there it is used to describe the wonders that Paul performed while he was in Ephesus. Those miracles would have had a particularly profound impact on the Ephesians, who were known for their interest in the occult. Many of the Ephesians believed in magic. They bought and sold spells, and they gathered in groups to watch visiting sorcerers attempt miracle cures. As a result, charlatans who claimed to have special abilities were drawn to this city. They offered to use their powers or to share them for a price. The reputation that Ephesus had of being a place full of magical con artists was so strong that it appears in a well-known description of the city contained in William Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors. In that work, the character Antipholus of Syracuse describes the city of Ephesus as follows. They say this town is full of cozenage, as nimbler jugglers that deceive the eye, dart-working sorcerers that change the mind, soul-killing witches that deform the body, disguised cheaters, prating mountebanks, and many such like liberties of sin. The fact that Ephesus was still remembered as a place where magical con artists flourished over 1,500 years after Acts 19 was written indicates how infamous it was as a place of magical trickery. Its long-standing reputation certainly indicates the historical validity of the scene with the sons of Sceva in Acts 19. Let's read verses 13 and 14. Then certain of the vagabond Jews, exorcists, took upon them to call over them which had evil spirits the name of the Lord Jesus, saying, We adjure you by Jesus, whom Paul preacheth. Remember those words and how they are phrased, because we're going to come back to that later. We adjure you by Jesus, whom Paul preacheth. And there were seven sons of one Sceva, a Jew and chief of the priests, which did so. Sceva's sons were among the many tricksters who came to Ephesus. Sceva's name means left-handed, a symbol that's so often associated with evil intent. Now, this, of course, is not meant to be a knock on the people who will be appearing in the left-handed individual photographs, but here's a fact. The English word sinister, that comes from the Latin word sinistra. And sinistra originally meant left. Later on, it came to be used for evil or for bad luck. Well, the King James Version describes Sceva as chief of the priests. It seems likely that he was one of the head of one of the 24 courses of priests that David set in order. Those courses are referred to numerous times in the Bible. But let's just go to Luke chapter 1. Where the courses are mentioned, and just to sort of demonstrate that this was still something that existed in the first century. So Luke chapter 1, verse 5, one course in particular is mentioned. There was, in the days of Herod, the king of Judea, a certain priest named Zacharias, of the course of Abia. Okay, so Abia, that was one of the 24 courses. And his wife was one of the daughters of Aaron, and her name was Elizabeth. Okay, so it's likely that Sceva might have been the head of one of those 24 courses, of which Abia was one of them. Sceva's sons traveled about and performed exorcisms. Now, this is a practice that's mentioned in Luke chapter 11. So let's just turn over a few pages to Luke chapter 11, and we're going to read verses 15 to 19, which just makes reference to this practice of people traveling about and performing these kinds of exorcisms. Luke 11, verse 15. But some of them said, and this is they're talking about the Lord here, he casteth out devils through Beelzebub, the chief of the devils. And others, tempting him, sought of him a sign from heaven. But he, knowing their thoughts, said unto them, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and a house divided against a house falleth. If Satan also be divided against himself, how shall his kingdom stand? Because ye say that I cast out devils through Beelzebub. And if I by Beelzebub cast out devils, by whom do your sons cast them out? Therefore shall they be your judges. The Bible's record of the attempt by the sons of Sceva to heal a man in Ephesus with a mental illness in Acts 19 is very much in harmony with the archaeological evidence of the practice of magic in Ephesus. The magical artifacts discovered in the area around Ephesus are part of the voluminous evidence of the historical accuracy of the Bible. In the first century, magicians in Ephesus used spells known as Ephesian letters to cure disease, to find love, to solve infertility, or to bring luck. These spells were combinations of words and characters thought to have power when used in a particular order. Here's the example of a dissolving spell meant to make things go away that was part of the just an example of the Ephesian letters. You can sort of see from the shape of the spell, something like this would be written down. It's sort of a series of characters, and characters gradually disappear, and it actually looks like something is disappearing. And so that's an example of what an Ephesian letter spell might look like. Use of Ephesian letters spells was associated with the worship of the Ephesians' goddess, Diana. And magical characters were written on the crown, the belt, and the feet of the image of Diana in the city's great temple. Spells of Ephesian letters were often comprised of little more than a few words or characters, like the one up that we've projected up. These spells were purchased in little scrolls. They were worn on the body, and they were pulled out when need arose. As Acts 19, verse 13 suggests, Jewish magicians were particularly popular in Ephesus, and there was a reason for that. They knew Hebrew, and they could invoke words and names from the Old Testament that sort of sounded magical, particularly to the Greek ear. And in fact, a number of magical scrolls that have been preserved contain Hebrew words like Sebaoth and names like Abraham in them. And so a person who was Jewish could pronounce them correctly and was thought to impart extra power to the magic on the scroll. Other scrolls provide pronunciation guides for the divine name to be used in spells. Now, it's really interesting that there's a pretty close parallel to the spell used in the Acts 19 record. And it's found on line 318 of the Paris Magical Papyrus, number 574. and it contains the words, "I adjure thee by Jesus, the God of the Hebrews." Now, why that's interesting is because it sounds a lot like, in terms of words used and overall structure, like the spell employed in Acts 19, and it certainly indicates for us how historically accurate the Bible's record of events is. Now, the sons of Sceva tried to use similar words to the one that's been preserved in the archaeological record to heal a mentally ill man in Ephesus. And it appears that they must have gathered a large company together to watch the anticipated healing. It's because they would have gathered people together that the events described in the Acts record came to be known to all the Jews and Greeks also dwelling at Ephesus, as is recorded in Acts 19, verse 17. So this occasion, when all of these Ephesians were gathered together, presented a wonderful opportunity for the truth to triumph over error. And so the magicians used words that are recorded in verse 13. They said, "We adjure you by Jesus, whom Paul preaches." Now, apparently the man that they were trying to cure was aware of the interest in Jesus and Paul that had developed in the city. And perhaps that's why the sons of Sceva selected him for this miracle cure. But after they spoke, the man replied, "Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are you?" In verse 15. This man's perception was sufficient to tell that the sons of Sceva were nothing more than charlatans. And his response is a remarkable illustration of the folly of those who believed in the magicians. Even a person who was not mentally sound could tell that these people were nothing more than frauds. Even more than that, the man leapt on them, overcame them, and prevailed against them. So desperate were the sons of Sceva to get away from this man that they shook off their clothes and fleeing from him. Verse 16 records that they fled naked and wounded. The inability of the sons of Sceva to restrain this man, let alone cure him, they couldn't even contain him. This sight was a remarkable demonstration to many of the people in Ephesus of the powerlessness of the magic that they had believed in and on which they had spent so much money. Now, there's an important lesson for us in this episode, and that is that a mere recognition of Jesus' power and an acknowledgement of his existence are not sufficient to save a person. The sons of Sceva knew that there was power associated with the name of Jesus, otherwise they wouldn't have attempted to use it. But that knowledge didn't do them any good because they didn't change their characters as a result of it. We need to make this a lesson for us. The transformation of a life through the power of the Lord Jesus Christ requires an understanding of the moral implications of his work. And more than that, it requires a commitment to follow in his footsteps. Well, many of the Ephesians came to recognize these truths. Verse 18 records that many of them believed. Their belief changed their lives. They acted on it. They renounced their old practices. And then they took practical steps to prevent them from easily returning to their old ways. And we are wise to do the same. When we make a change in our lives because of the Lord Jesus Christ, we need to do where possible the things that have to be done to keep us from easily drifting back to our old way of life. And so what these individuals did is that they openly confessed that what they had done before was wrong. That's recorded in Acts 19, verse 18. And then they destroyed many of the objects associated with their former habits, as is described in verse 19. Acts 19, 19 states that the value of the magical items that were destroyed was 50,000 drachmas. Now, the point from this is that that's a large amount of money. We can try to turn that into modern terms, but we're only going to get a general sense. But here's an idea about the value of what was destroyed. Since a drachma was approximately the daily wage of a skilled worker, that amount of 50,000 drachmas could be estimated to be the equivalent of about $9 million in 2010. Now, it's interesting to note that these people destroyed their magical items. They didn't sell them, even though the proceeds from the sale of them could have gone to a good cause, such as the Jerusalem Poor Fund that Paul was actively collecting at this time. But their decision to destroy their magical items and not to sell them is very much in harmony with the Bible's teachings. Let's go over to Deuteronomy chapter 23. And this verse, Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 18, makes the point that money gotten from unwholesome sources was not supposed to be used in the service of God. I'm going to read from the RSV, Deuteronomy 23, 18. You shall not bring the hire of a harlot or the wages of a dog into the house of the Lord your God in payment for any vow, for both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. And of course, there were practical benefits from their act as well. If the Ephesians had sold their magical items, they could have been acquired by others who would use them. And the Christians, of course, didn't want that. Plus, this very dramatic public renunciation of their old ways gave them a chance to proclaim to everyone that they were turning away from their trust of magic and that instead they were embracing the gospel message. The effect was so dramatic. The English Standard Version of verse 20 is rendered as, So the word of the Lord continued to increase and prevail mightily. Well, with the spread of the gospel so well underway, and with thriving ecclesias having been established in the area, Paul began to make plans to leave Ephesus. Verse 21 states that he wanted to go to Macedonia and to Achaia. He undoubtedly wanted to complete the collection of the Jerusalem Poor Fund there. After going to those places, he wanted his next major stop to be Jerusalem. There, his intent was to give the fund to the poor Christians of the city. And thereafter, he wanted to go to Rome. Paul sent Timothy and Erastus ahead of him into Macedonia to prepare for his arrival. That's recorded in verse 22. Erastus, who was in Ephesus at the time, was from Corinth, and he eventually made his way back to Corinth. The epistle to the Romans was written from Corinth, and by the time it was written, Erastus was back there. And so the epistle to the Romans contains a greeting from him. Let's go there. Let's go to Romans chapter 16. There is a particular detail that we want to note about that. Romans 16, verse 23 reads, "Gaius, mine host, and of the whole ecclesia saluteth you. Erastus, the chamberlain of the city, saluteth you, and Quartus, a brother." If you have the English Standard Version, it renders the phrase regarding Erastus as Erastus, the city treasurer. So as this verse notes, Erastus was the treasurer of the city of Corinth. And the interesting thing is there is evidence of his existence in the archaeological record. In 1921, a pavement found near the theater in Corinth contains an inscription that is probably from him. It states, "Erastus, the procurator of public buildings, laid this pavement at his own expense." This man, Erastus, was a faithful brother, but not all things were right in Corinth. Paul began to hear of problems in the ecclesia there from Corinthian visitors who came to see him in Ephesus. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 11, mentions a delegation that came from the household of Chloe. They told Paul about the factions that had formed in the ecclesia. Let's go there and read from 1 Corinthians chapter 1. In verse 11, Paul writes, "For it hath been declared unto me of you, my brethren, by them which are of the house of Chloe, that there are contentions among you. Some in the meeting of Corinth were claiming to be followers of Paul, others of Peter, still others of Apollos, and some who were trying to sound superior to the rest said that they followed Christ." Hearing of these factions would have undoubtedly been distressing to Paul. He and Peter and Apollos all labored tirelessly for the cause of Christ. Although they had different strengths, they each complemented one another's work. So the idea of developing personal followings and competing against each other, well, that was absolutely abhorrent to these men. Now, on the surface, the difference between the styles of Paul and Apollos in particular would have been pretty obvious to the sophisticated Corinthians. Recall that Apollos was a gifted orator. Paul himself says that he was not. Turn over to just the page to 1 Corinthians chapter 2, and let's see what he says of himself in verse 1. He writes, "And I, brethren, when I came to you, came not with excellency of speech or of wisdom, declaring unto you the testimony of God." But these differences in style were completely superficial. They were related to fleshly characteristics and abilities, and such things should have no bearing whatsoever on spiritual matters. So, even though these two men had very different approaches, they supported one another's work. What's more, there's absolutely no hint of jealousy of the gifts that the other had. In fact, the Bible's evidence suggests that they had a great deal of love one for another. Let's go to Titus chapter 3. There we can consider the care that Paul shows for Apollos when he writes to Titus concerning him some years later. Titus chapter 3, verse 13. I'm going to read from the English Standard Version. Titus 3, verse 13. "Do your best to speed Zenas the lawyer and Apollos on their way." And then he adds, "See that they lack nothing." Paul is clearly looking out for Apollos' well-being here. And the support extended, indicated by that phrase, "see that they lack nothing," that support was probably financed from Paul's own pocket. Let's return to the time of Acts 19, however. Apollos was with Paul in Ephesus when the delegation from the household of Chloe arrived in Ephesus with news of the factions that had developed in Corinth, including the faction that had developed around Apollos. Even though there was a faction claiming him as their leader in Corinth, Apollos was no longer there. He was back in Ephesus. So Paul, after hearing this news, suggested that Apollos should return to Corinth. But Apollos decided not to. We read about this in 1 Corinthians chapter 16. And this is going to be in the letter that Paul writes in response to hearing about all these issues. So he's evidently talked to Apollos and encouraged him to go back to Corinth. But Apollos refuses, as 1 Corinthians 16:12 states. As touching our brother Apollos, I greatly desired him to come unto you with the brethren, but his will was not at all to come at this time, but he will come when he shall have convenient time. Apollos' decision not to go back to Corinth was a rebuke of all those in the ecclesia who had set him forth as a leader of their faction. By refusing to go back to be with them, he was clearly demonstrating that he did not approve of their party spirit. If Apollos had been driven by human pride or motivated by personal ambition, he would have leapt at the opportunity to return to Corinth and to be with his supporters. But Apollos' desire was to serve God, even when doing so came at a personal cost to him. Paul's mindset was absolutely the same. And by keeping their focus on serving God and bringing glory to him, by keeping their thoughts right, Paul and Apollos helped to resolve what could have been an explosive problem in the ecclesia. Moreover, these brethren did not allow a potentially divisive situation to harm their relationship with one another. The attitude of Paul and Apollos during this time and their willingness to use their gifts together in the service of the Lord sets a wonderful example for believers in all ages to follow. Paul called himself and Apollos laborers together with God in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 9. That's the mindset and that's the attitude we should have with regard to our brothers and sisters. Viewing each other in that way can help us to sustain our relationships, even during times when they could otherwise become strained by the difficulties that sometimes arise in ecclesial life. Well, there were other problems in Corinth besides the forming of these factions that Paul heard of at this time. The ecclesia was tolerating gross sexual immorality by members of the meeting. And they were doing so even though Paul had explicitly warned them not to keep company with fornicators in an earlier epistle. That's mentioned in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9. Another distressing problem was that brethren were taking one another to court. This was a bad scene, but all was not totally lost in Corinth. Paul could tell because a letter arrived from the Corinthians asking him questions about a host of other matters, including marriage, meat sacrifice to idols, the conduct of worship services, the gifts of the Holy Spirit, and the resurrection. And the fact that the Corinthians had reached out to Paul in this way to ask him questions demonstrated that even though there were great problems in their midst, that they remained teachable and that they sought further guidance to become better followers of the Lord. The letter posing these questions from the Corinthians to Paul while Paul was in Ephesus was carried by Stephanas, Fortunatus, and Achaicus. Paul writes that he was very pleased to receive this letter at the end of his epistle in 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verse 17 mentions this epistle. I'm going to read from the English Standard Version. I rejoiced at the coming of Stephanas and Fortunatus and Achaicus, because they have made up for your absence. Well, 1 Corinthians was the letter that Paul wrote in response to all of these issues, both what he heard about from the household of Chloe, as well as in response to the letter that he received that was carried by these three brethren mentioned in 1 Corinthians 16, verse 17. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 8 shows that 1 Corinthians was probably written from Ephesus and that these events occurred during the time of Acts 19. Just note verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 16, but I will tarry at Ephesus until Pentecost. And the epistles to the Corinthians offer insight into Paul's experiences and the feelings that he was having while he was in Ephesus. The problems that were occurring in Corinth weighed heavily on his mind during the time in which he was at Ephesus, for example. He speaks of the anguish that they caused him when he reflects back on the writing of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians chapter 2. So just to make clear, so in 2 Corinthians chapter 2, he's going to make reference to what he felt when he was writing 1 Corinthians from Ephesus. So 2 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 4. For out of much affliction and anguish of heart, I wrote unto you with many tears, not that ye should be grieved, but that ye might know the love which I have more abundantly unto you. In addition to that burden that he was experiencing and his concern for the ecclesia at Corinth, 1 Corinthians lists many of the difficulties that Paul faced during his time at Ephesus. Many of these problems were really quite extreme. They're not presented in detail in the Acts record, but we learn about them from considering the epistles to the Corinthians. Here's an example. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And we're going to start at verse 11. So here he's writing about what he felt when he was in Ephesus and what was going on. 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 11. Even unto this present hour, we both hunger and thirst, and are naked, and are buffeted, and have no certain dwelling place, and labor, working with our own hands, being reviled, we bless, being persecuted, we suffer it, being defamed, we entreat. We are made as the filth of the world, and are the offscouring of all things unto this day. In addition to deprivation and weariness, Paul makes reference to the adversaries who were contending against him at this time. These were ferocious people. He compares them to wild animals. Let's turn over just a few pages to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, and I'm going to read verse 32 from the English Standard Version. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 32, he writes, "What do I gain if, humanly speaking, I fought with beasts at Ephesus? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die." Without the resurrection, Paul concludes, believers who follow in his footsteps would be of all men most miserable. That's mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 19. But Paul did believe in the resurrection, and that gave him great hope. And he trusted in God. Therefore, he refused material assistance from the members of the ecclesia in Ephesus. That's referred to in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 11 to 15. And even though he was opposed, violently imposed, in fact, by both Jews and Gentiles in Ephesus, he still endeavored with all of his might to reach out to both groups and to share the gospel with him. Let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 9, where this dedication on his part is mentioned. Starting at verse 20. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 20. And unto the Jews I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. To them that are under the law is under the law,
that I might gain them that are under the law. To them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law. That's, of course, a reference to the Gentiles who were not under the law of Moses. And because Paul believed in God, he had a sure hope, and he knew what course of action to pursue. So, in spite of all the really, really challenging things that happened to him while he was in Ephesus, he still maintained a positive outlook, bearing in mind all of these difficulties, hunger, deprivation, weariness, scores of adversaries. Bearing in mind all of those things, it is remarkable to consider how he characterizes the situation that faced him in Ephesus. It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 9. Think about these words in the context of all that he had to endure. This is what he thinks about Ephesus. 1 Corinthians 16, verse 9. For a great door and effectual is opened unto me, and there are many adversaries. Isn't that remarkable, brothers and sisters? Paul viewed what was going on in Ephesus as an opportunity. Paul's attitude here really is worthy of our consideration. All too often, we can faint early in the face of difficulty. His example shows how resilient we can be and how much we can accomplish for our God, regardless of the problems that we encounter, if we maintain our trust in him. Well, when Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, he was planning on staying at Ephesus for a little while longer. He told the Corinthians that he wanted to stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. Pentecost is in the late spring. He figured that Timothy, who he had sent ahead, might arrive in Corinth before him. So he told the Corinthians to be sure that they didn't make Timothy afraid. He mentions that in 1 Corinthians 16:10. He told them not to despise him in verse 11. Then Paul sent 1 Corinthians by the hand of Titus, who was with him in Ephesus at the time. Shortly after he wrote the epistle to the Corinthians, the first epistle to the Corinthians, the situation in Ephesus changed dramatically for the Christians living there. The spread of the gospel was causing many of the people who lived in Asia to lose interest in the goddess Diana. And the public burning of the magical items certainly would have contributed to that sentiment. The impact of Paul's preaching was particularly felt in Ephesus. That's where Diana worship was headquartered, and where the temple built for her honor had stood. That temple was a grandiose structure with a long history. Historians can now reconstruct in great detail what the temple of Diana looked like. That's because the archaeological evidence is so extensive, and it's so wonderful for us, brothers and sisters, to know that it points squarely in support of the Acts 19 record. The Ephesians' Temple of Diana was known to be one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It burned down the night that Alexander the Great was born, and it took 120 years to complete the reconstruction of the Temple of Diana. Now, by comparison, John chapter 2, verse 20 states that the construction of Herod's temple in Jerusalem took 46 years. The Temple of Diana took 120 years to be reconstructed. When it was finished, the Temple of Diana stood on a base 425 feet long and 200 feet wide. The roof of the temple was supported by over 120 columns that were 60 feet high. It's been estimated that the Temple of Diana could hold 50,000 people, so it was considerably larger than many of the buildings in antiquity, including the Parthenon in Athens, for example. And it was lavishly decorated. Its striking facade of red and blue and gold marble abounded with precious metals. Sculptures adorned the base of its columns. The rich kept their wealth and their valuables there, and the temple housed a priceless art collection. Many of these treasures were brought out into the streets of Ephesus during festivals to Diana, and that would have increased the people's awe of this great structure. Diana was represented as a many-breasted woman. She was regarded as a mother goddess and the nourisher of life. Her worship was associated with vile practices connected to the ideas of reproduction and fertility. Note that she has a turreted crown upon her head, reminiscent of the Tower of Babel. Indeed, numerous connections between the worship of Ephesian Diana and Babylonian-style worship have been identified. The combination of her crown and her outstretched arms give her an eerie resemblance to apostate depictions of Mary. Indeed, the obvious influence of Diana on Orthodox understandings of Mary has not been lost on commentators from a wide variety of backgrounds. For example, Diana was worshipped as a mother of gods, and men who devoted themselves to her took vows of celibacy. As part of their worship, devotees of Diana purchased images of her in the temple. These idols could be made of terracotta, marble, or precious metals. Those who venerated the goddess wore these objects. They kept them in their homes, and they placed them in the graves of their dead. In Acts 19, the silversmith Demetrius is recorded as saying that all Asia and the world worship Diana. His remarks are an exaggeration, but the worship of Diana was indeed widespread. More than 30 ancient cities claimed Diana as their patroness. Sales of the objects of Diana would have increased during the many civic and cultural activities in the city associated with her worship. Numerous festivals with athletic, theatrical, and musical competitions were held in her honor. But the height of Diana worship occurred in late spring during the month the Ephesians called Artemision. It was named after their goddess. The Greeks called Diana Artemis. It was probably during Artemision that the riot described in Acts 19 took place. Again, the Bible's record is in accordance with history, down to the most minor details. Paul wrote 1 Corinthians near the end of his stay in Ephesus. In that epistle, he stated his intention to remain in Ephesus until late spring. So he must have written 1 Corinthians before it was late spring. Therefore, there's a good chance that he was in Ephesus near the beginning of the month Artemision. Perhaps he hoped to spend his final days in Ephesus preaching to the crowds of visitors who came to the city during that time. It's easy to imagine Demetrius and the other image makers gathering at the beginning of the month to complain about the impact that Paul's preaching was having on the sale of their idols. Their religion thrived on the pursuit of personal gain. Notice how money is referred to in Acts 19, 24, 25, and 27. Demetrius's focus in making his speech was a marked contrast to the call to self-sacrifice for God that Paul and the Christians proclaimed. Acts 19, 28 records that the craftsmen grew angry as they listened to him speak about the effect of the gospel preaching on their livelihood. They began to shout, "Great is Diana of the Ephesians." Historians believe that the silversmith's guild in Ephesus was situated near the Agora. The Agora was where the marketplace was located. So the crowds gathered there would have heard the uproar, and Acts records that the multitude began to get involved. The marble road was close by, and it led to this great theater. So it was a natural progression for the riot to move in that direction. This close connection between the Bible's record and historical evidence is yet another of the many indicators of the inspiration of the Scriptures. The Great Theater still stands today. It can seat approximately 25,000 people, but many more than that were probably crowded into it on the day of the riot. The theater is anchored on the slopes of Mount Pion, and it has excellent acoustics. It is said that a person speaking in a normal voice from the center of the theater can be heard in the highest seats. So the noise from the tumult would have carried throughout the city. Inside the theater, The sound the shouting crowd was making would have been deafening. But God is with his people. Even when it seems that their world is crumbling to the ground. And he was with Paul and his traveling companions on the day of the riot. In our next class, we will consider what else happened on that day and how Paul spent the last of his time in the company of the ecclesia in Ephesus.